podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 878, recorded Sunday, June 5th, 2022. Having my baby. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Wealthfront. To start building your wealth and getting your first $5,000 managed free for life, go to wealthfront.com/twit. And by Podium. Join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today at podium.com/twit. And by Indochino. If you've got a big day coming up, getting the perfect look is no big deal. With Indochino, get $50 off any purchase of $3.99 or more by using the promo code TWIT at Indochino.com. And by Nereva. Traditional audio conferencing systems can entail lots of components. Installation could take days, and you might not get the mic coverage you need. That's complex, expensive, but Nereva Audio is easy to install and manage. No technicians required, and you get true full room coverage. Now that's easy economical. Learn more at Nereva.com. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, kind of a different show today because of something in the studio that went wrong. I am going to be hosting it from my house, and that's okay because we're still going to have a great TWiT because we have a better than great panel. First of all, haven't seen Jill in so long. Jill Duffy, Deputy Managing Editor at PC Mag. It is great to see you. Welcome
back. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
Yeah. How are things going at PC Mag?
Good. We are chugging along. We just had our 40th anniversary of PC Magazine. So new editor-in-chief this year, the first female editor-in-chief we've ever had, and lots of big milestones. And in my personal life, I just had a book come out earlier this year.
Nice.
Appropriately enough, as you're working from home today, is the Everything Guide to Remote Work. So everything you need to know, from where to find remote jobs, how to interview, how to handle your AV issues, the whole shebang in one book.
Did you think when you came out in January, oh, shoot, I missed the pandemic. I wish I'd written this faster.
No, I had been covering remote work for a long time, just here and there. And then suddenly with the pandemic, there was just, you know, such a need for more information. So I felt really lucky to have been following the trends prior to that, to know like, what do remote first companies do? How do they do it? How do they do it well? What have they learned in the last 15 years they've been doing it? So it's been really great to be able to share some of that with people who genuinely need it right now and continue to need it.
Well, as it turned out, yeah. In fact, nobody wants to go back to work. That's kind of the story we've been covering the last few weeks and months. Yeah. Everybody says, yeah, let's not go back to work. Let's work from home. So perfect timing. Who publishes that and where can we get it?
It's Adams Media and Simon & Schuster, and you can buy it both in a physical print book or as an ebook.
Nice.
Anywhere you buy your books. I like to turn people on to IndieBound. IndieBound hooks you up with a local independent bookstore based on your postal code.
God knows. Let's support the independents. Thank you, Jill. Also here, Alex Wilhelm. It's great to see you, deputy. Senior editor. You're not a deputy. You're a senior. At TechCrunch.
Actually, I'm neither. I've gotten promoted.
Wait a minute, let me edit that. Who are you now?
I'm the editor-in-chief of TechCrunch Plus, which is our stuff behind the paywall.
Oh, nice. Is that with a plus sign or PLUS? How do we spell it?
It's with a plus sign, or if you're on Twitter, it's PLUS, because that's how usernames work.
Great to see you. Good to be Alex, also with us, thrilled to have Dan Gilmore back on our microphones such as they are today. Dan is a co-founder of the Arizona State University News Collab at the Walter Cronkite Journalism School and a journalism expert and a great fella. Thank you, Dan. Good to see you again.
Great to be back.
So I thought when we were preparing the show that WWDC be the big story. Well, then Sheryl Sandberg decided to quit. And that has to be the big story. Let me start with you, Jill, because Cheryl became almost a feminist icon some years ago when she published Lean In. She survived, you know, the death of her husband and a lot of adversity, and became more and really more and more important at Meta. I don't think she had the role when she first started. She had the name chief operating officer, but I think she really became more and more important as Mark Zuckerberg's partner over the years.
Yeah, I mean, she was always kind of known as the grown-up in the room, right? She was the one who brought a little bit of an air of professionalism, kind of held things together. And it's hard to judge anybody for stepping down when they've been in a position for a long time in a company that's had taken a lot of heat, and rightfully so. It sounds like there may be some issues related to burnout for her. So, you know, I don't fault her for stepping down.
Absolutely not. Although Meta had just been kind of reorganized with the annunciation of Nick Clegg to do global affairs, it looked like a triumvirate for a while. So they had Mark Zuckerberg handling the software and the technologies, and then Sheryl Sandberg running the business, and then Nick Clegg fending off the government attacks. Alex, what does this do to the structure? She won't be leaving till this fall.
Yeah.
But does this change how Meta runs?
I think so. And I think it's indicative of the change in the company's focus. I mean, Sheryl Sandberg is synonymous with the company's advertising business because she was really brought on to build that. And now as the company moves more towards the metaverse, which I think is one of the squishiest concepts in all of the history of technology, I think it just – she makes less sense as the obvious number two. And honestly, just speaking as a human, who wants to be one of two and then suddenly told you're going to be one of three?
Well, that's true.
It feels like a demotion by dilution.
Although I would think she would want the shield that Nick Clegg – I mean, the biggest headwind for Meta these days is government inquiries, right? And let Nick handle – that's what I felt like Mark was saying. Oh, we don't have to do this, Cheryl. Let's just let Nick handle that. He's like Mikey. He'll do anything. Just let him do it.
I just, you know, if I was her and I had had this one particular job that I had run for so long, and then the company that I had essentially built, the financial side of it at least, said, hey, we're going to pivot and do something else entirely different.
Right.
I would be like, cool, have fun. I've already made my money. I'm going to go sit on a boat. And you would never, personally, you would never hear from me again. I would be too busy enjoying the sun and an endless supply of, I don't know, margaritas or whatever.
She, in an interview after she announced her resignation, she said, this shouldn't be taken as a sign that Meta is moving away from the advertising business, which is probably right since it's 98% of their revenue. Javier Olivan will succeed her. He is head of product engineering, and he'll take over ad sales as well. But I wonder, Dan, if this isn't really, as Alex says, kind of a sign of the times for Meta, that they are moving to the metaverse.
Hard for me to know. I should make a disclosure before I say anything, and that is that the Facebook Journalism Project funded one of our projects,
as it did Jeff Jarvis's as well. They've been very good, actually, doing that. Yeah.
So, you know, saying that there's a sort of this triumvirate that was forming, it's hard to be part of a triumvirate where one person controls everything.
That's all the shares.
I think the best description of the structure of Facebook is that it's an empire with an emperor, and it isn't her, and it isn't this, it isn't Clegg. It's Zuckerberg. It's hard to suggest to me anyway that much is going to change.
She says she wants to focus on her philanthropic efforts. And she intimated that for a woman with a high profile, this is an important time to become an activist, probably referring to Roe v. Wade and other women's issues. But there's also been some, you know, nattering about maybe political ambitions. Dianne Feinstein's 88. She's up for a re-election in 2 years. Our senator from California, I could see. You think, Jill, that's part of the equation?
You know, it's not something that I follow very closely. I think, you know, the larger issue that I see here is that we put so much pressure and spotlight on people who are executives. What are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? It's I don't know. I don't follow any of her political ambitions, so I don't know. But, you know, I don't know. I'd be just as happy to see people, you know, fade out and do what they want to do.
The thing I'd throw in there, Jill, is that, I mean, if you keep going to Davos and you keep sitting on stage, you put yourself into the conversation to a degree. Now, that doesn't mean that she has to do anything next. I mean, again, I would be on a boat. But, you know, Dianne Feinstein was my senator when I lived in California for a while. And it's probably time for a fresh face. And we have seen, I think, business people, generally speaking, presume that they can translate their experience into the political sphere. Don't forget Howard Schultz, Starbucks man himself, tried to run for president, I believe it was, before Biden ran. And
didn't get very far either, did he?
No. Turns out money and business acumen do not always translate into electoral politics. And so to me, I doubt that just because I don't think it would go that well.
Jill, I agree. Burnout is probably a big part of it. She's estimated her net worth is $1.6 billion. She doesn't probably have to do anything. She's got kids. She remarried and or is about to remarry, actually, next month. That might be the other reason. I mean, she's got a new family. She might want to spend time with them. And you know what? God bless her. That's not an issue really for us to worry about. More interest is what it means to Meta. Mark's spending $10 billion a year. He's got 18,000 engineers working on whatever this next thing is, metaverse is. Clearly, that's Mark's focus. And by the way, people have said that Javier's, her successor, is not going to be the same powerhouse that Sandberg was. So maybe this is kind of – is it kind of the beginning of the deceleration for Facebook, the social network?
You know what's funny about this? If you think about the end of the Google era with the founders, they kind of stepped away. So did Eric Schmidt, who was their adult in the room, back to Jill's earlier point about what Sheryl's done for Facebook, Meta. We're seeing the opposite. We're almost seeing a doubling down from Zuck, if you will, because if the replacement for Sheryl is going to have less power internally, and as you know, Dan pointed out, it's certainly soft power because it's not based on voting control of the company. He seems to concentrate more power back in the hands of the monarch or the emperor, depending on which phrase you prefer.
He does have the power anyway, regardless. He's making a big bet. I mean, if all your money comes from advertising, and that will probably continue for some time, still to focus so much of your energies and 18,000 engineers and all that money on the metaverse is a big bet. It's a big gamble.
18,000 engineers doing what? Is my question.
Good question. Maybe I got that number wrong. I think that's what I remember. I might have that wrong.
Gerald, Dan, do you guys play games? Are you interested in the metaverse? Because to me, I'm a gamer and a person who has a PC that can run this stuff. And I keep waiting to care.
No interest.
I don't.
No.
You know what? Many, many years ago, I was, I worked for Game Developer Magazine. I was the managing editor of Game Developer Magazine. And this is the early 2000s. And there was so much talk even then about, you know, what's going to happen with mobile games? Cause that was still like pre-iPhone days. What are mobile games going to do? How they're going to, you know, some customized advertising to you based on your location. And there was this whole immersive technology idea, which I guess we're now sort of calling the metaverse. And like, it comes up in conversation, but it's a matter of what do people actually want? What do people want to engage with? And I think you'll always get a slim number of people who are willing to go all in and try it out and be on Second Life and have their classroom there and whatever else. But like, will it catch on with everybody? My answer is no. I don't think it's going to be a big explosion.
It's a hard thing when you're a tech company. We always talk about the innovator's dilemma. Apple's in the same boat where 52% of their revenue now comes from one product. It's always a challenge to say, well, you know, this engine isn't going to go forever. What's the next lily pad we're going to leap to? And I think it makes sense for Facebook to be looking for another lily pad, but I agree with both of you. I don't feel like the metaverse is going to be the next big thing. That's what you think. You think that if you read a lot of science fiction,
they've done a good job of sort of, using acquisitions to spread out what their business does a little bit, right? Like if you look at WhatsApp and Instagram and Facebook, those are sort of the three big pillars, right? But they own a whole lot more than that. And I think that may have been strategically, in a business sense, their best move to date is sort of diversify through acquisitions.
But how do they monetize WhatsApp? They haven't. I mean, they're not putting ads. I haven't used WhatsApp in a long time. They don't put ads in it, right? I don't know if they can even monetize that. That's really more of a service than a profit center. Instagram, I do use, and it's worse and worse all the time, isn't it? It's terrible. I see photographers now saying, where do we go? What do we use? This is not a good place to show off your photography. It's now, it's looking like Facebook. It's so algorithmic that you don't know what you're going to see. Half what I see, I don't even know who these people are.
Maybe some of these issues are, this is, you know, my fond wish that never has come true yet, that we're going to go back to a truly decentralized creator economy, not a Web 3, by the way, no. As it's developing, no. But yeah. where blogging the way it was makes a comeback, where a number of things happen. Hallelujah. To give people their own platforms where they don't live or die at the whim of a couple of very large companies. So if I had a wish, it would be that all of these moves in the end become irrelevant.
Okay, Don Quixote.
No, I mean, shout out to Dan for saying that. I mean,
I'm with you 100%.
Yeah.
Look at the popularity of email newsletters.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's true. There is this kind of new writer as auteur thing. Maybe that's some of it. Podcasting is consolidating. It's going to be a few big companies, and that's that.
It's noteworthy on newsletters that a venture-funded company is trying to basically create a monopoly there. So on a platform basis. So be careful, we get what we wish for.
Isn't that what Tim Wu says happens, though? It's inevitable, is this kind of consolidation aggregation?
Yes, but he was talking about telecom and media in a different way, I think. But Tim's book is must read for everybody on this topic.
Yeah. Can we go back to Leo's point about Instagram becoming Facebook? Because there seems to be a parallel here between what we observe in the world of fintech and what we see in the world of social networks. And in fintech, all companies end up looking like one another. Like Square started off with a little credit card reader. Now it does, you know, a zillion million things that are very similar to what SoFi does, all fintech kind of becomes the same thing over time. I wonder if there's like a crapification endpoint for all social networks when they essentially become so over optimized for near term ad incomes that the user experience must be essentially whacked with a stick repeatedly.
I think there's a lot of examples of that. You know, what's interesting is that Twitter. You would expect Twitter to become like that. And it seems to be resilient to that somewhat.
They're killing TweetDeck, Leo. I'm sorry. They're killing my
they're not killing
Mac app.
They're killing the Mac app, which is just an Electron interface to the web. The web is still going to be there. You can use a browser.
No. I'm sorry.
I love TweetDeck. It's the only way to use Twitter because you can control it and there's no ads.
I go to great lengths to not put apps on devices and use web interfaces wherever possible.
Yeah.
I read an article recently about how I got myself off of Instagram the same way. So I don't use the Instagram app. I still look at it, but I use it on a mobile web browser and it is so pared down. It looks nothing like TikTok when you use it that way. Oh. You don't get as many videos pushed in your face and you only see content from people you follow. It's adding a little bit of friction can help.
That's brilliant. I'm going to have to start doing that. I don't want – Instagram's the only – Facebook property, Meta property that I have an account with. And it's just so that because they set it up, you can't show Instagram pictures. And I like to show people's images and stuff without an account. Actually, the same thing with Facebook, but I don't care. When I pulled up Sheryl Sandberg's message, there's a 1/3 of the screen is, well, you're not a member. Join, log in. No. Just read around.
You know, you mentioned that you don't use WhatsApp and, Leo, as you know, I've kind of lived in a couple of different places around the world, and it's really hard to impress upon people in the United States how much WhatsApp is used outside of the US. So it's not just for person-to-person communication, but it's also businesses. So, you know, my friends in Colombia, when they order takeout food, they WhatsApp the restaurant
Yeah.
And send a direct payment, and that's how their food comes. Like, WhatsApp really fills in a lot of gaps in mobile offerings outside of the US in ways that people don't seem to understand. And the other kicker to this is that a lot of phone companies outside of the US will offer WhatsApp messages or Facebook Messenger messages for free so that it doesn't deplete people's data usage. And that's really how they've gotten their claws in.
I like Dave Gilmore's scare quotes when you said free. But that, remember, internet.org, that was Facebook's attempt to become the internet for a whole bunch of developing nations. India said, no, we have a good experience with colonialism. Not a good experience. Yep. We have a history.
Not
this time.
We don't
want to do it again. Not this time. Not again.
Yeah.
We're having, this is kind of a different kind of twit. It's a little more, I think it's a twit kind of fireside chat after hours, sitting around talking with smart people. Jill Duffy is here from PC Magazine, from ASU's Walter Cronkite School. Great to see Dan Gilmore. And of course, my good friend, Alex Wilhelm from TechCrunch Plus, or as we say it in France, TechCrunch Plus.
I'm here for that. Can someone do it in a German accent? We can just keep this going, because why not?
We're going to take a little break. Come back. Lots more on This Week in Tech. Hey, our show today brought to you by something I've been telling my kids for years, Wealthfront. I know it's so much fun to buy NFTs and fantasize about how much money you're going to make off your Dogecoin investments. But honestly, playing the stock market, buying individual stocks, buying cryptocurrency, that's fun, but it's a little risky. I would say it should be enjoyed in moderation, something like casino gambling or questionable street food. When it comes to building your wealth for the future, day trading stocks is not the secret to success. Wealthfront, in fact, has a ton of data to show that time in the market almost always beats timing the market. Wealthfront's going to build based on questions they ask you, things like your risk tolerance, your goals, your planning. What are you planning for retirement, college fund, buying that first house. So you're going to tell them what your plans are, your time frame is, and then they will build a globally diversified portfolio. Three important words, globally diversified portfolio, that will automatically optimize over time to hit the goals you set and the risk level you choose. You also get things that only Wealthfront could do. They invented something called tax loss harvesting. They actually invented the software. It basically lets you, when the stock market is down, reap tax benefits so that when the stock goes up, you have something to offset your gains. It's actually a brilliant way to balance your investment. That's what Wealthfront's all about. You can personalize your portfolio. They have a selection of funds. Again, portfolio handpicked by Wealthfront's financial experts. Categories include social responsibility, clean energy. Yes, you can do cryptocurrency, but by creating that basket of funds, it's a much less risky investment. They've got cannabis. They've got all kinds of stuff. So because they know people like to have, a little bit of say in what the investments are. When we started talking about Wealthfront some years ago, they were just getting started. They are now $27 billion in assets. 500,000 people use it. And good news, Investopedia just named Wealthfront the best robo-advisor for 2022. And we're just halfway through the year to start building your wealth and get your first $5,000 managed free for life. Go to wealthfront.com/twit. WEALTH, wealthfront, FRONT.com/twit to start building your wealth. Get started today. Wealthfront.com/twit. And now back to our panel. Back again with our panel. I guess if we're talking about Meta's ambitions in the metaverse, we can't leave out Apple's supposed metaverse ambitions. Tomorrow, WWDC, the Worldwide Developers Conference. Apple seems to have already gone, I think, to, Apple, I'm convinced, maybe you can, Dan, give me some insight into this. We used to be the Wall Street Journal, but there are various journalists or gossip mongers, whatever, that Apple can go sub rosa go to and say, psst, hey, don't say I said this, but we're not going to announce anything on Monday. And then you'll see this kind of bubbling up. Sometimes it'll say, well, I've heard from my sources, but more often it's just, I have a feeling. And that's what I'm starting to see from Mark Gurman Ming Chi Kuo and others, some of the rumor mills, Renee Ritchie on MacBreak Weekly kind of echoed this. Don't get your hopes up tomorrow for hardware. We were thinking maybe tomorrow Apple would announce or at least talk about its first. We know that, or we've heard that they plan to release this year headset. Dan, is that how Apple works? Do they kind of do this little subtle?
I can only speak to how Apple used to work. Right. And also for context, that I was never the one they leaked to.
Me neither.
So, they selected their journalists and made sure they were well cared for.
Walt Mossberg, Steve Jobs was like basically groomed Walt Mossberg to use a modern term.
Well, and Stephen Levy and a few others, there was a group that Steve Jobs favored, and that was that. But I don't know about this idea of spreading a, you know, don't say that because it's not going to happen thing, though smart companies do that.
Sure. Well, they want to lower expectations, right? They don't want the story from tomorrow to be Apple didn't announce it. What's wrong? Yeah. Right.
Yeah, as unexpected, right. Apple didn't do. That's a weird.
I'm even hearing they might not announce any hardware. About half of WWDC's, it's a developers conference. They don't announce any hardware.
Well, so. they often announce something that developers want to see, right. Like a high powered desktop or laptop. But it wouldn't surprise me to see some hardware announcements in the processor category, like the M2 and the and some indication of where they're going with the headset, which the more I read about, the less I understand. So
can we just push back against the Apple PR strategy here and just get outraged that they're not going to show off the headset tomorrow? Like, screw this pre-work.
Let's get disappointed now. Yeah. Is that what
How
you're
dare
saying?
They? What a disappointment. I'm only being half facetious because I am excited about what Apple's going to build in the headset department because, like I said, waiting for this technology to grab me. And Apple has a history of making me buy new stuff.
$3,000, 14 cameras, some of them pointing out, but some of them pointing in. These are all rumors. So that, and we have this vision of googly eyes on the front because you're wearing this headset, you know, I'll have to simulate it with this. I'm wearing the headset. No one can see what I'm thinking or looking, but if you put googly eyes on the front, so if there's a camera, so these are all rumors. For some reason, more than two screens, you only need one per eye. Don't know what the other screens would be, but maybe that would make sense. Then there's two in the back and one in the front. These are all rumors. Here's the thing. It is a developers conference. If you want developers to line up, you get one chance a year to pitch them on what the thing that they should be working on. If you've got something called Reality OS, which that's the trademark, you better tell them about it tomorrow, right?
I don't know. I'm going to challenge that, the idea that Apple gets one chance to persuade people of anything, because the obsession of tech journalism with Apple means that they could drop an announcement, you know, at 4 a.m. Saturday morning, and it would be worldwide news by 11.
Mea culpa. We'd be talking about it for days. You're right. They don't need this tomorrow.
But you're right, though, Leo. They do congregate developers, provide company resources.
This is when you say to developers, here's our priorities.
Yeah.
I think you're both right. I think Dan's right. You could make ripples. But I do think getting the actual developers together into one room, quote, is relatively infrequent. And it's why big companies that have platforms, you know, host developer-focused events. I mean, I've been going to these since I was 22.
Are you going tomorrow?
No, I have been assigned to do the stock market reaction post, which is usually me just talking about the stock market
down.
From a philosophical perspective.
Doesn't it always go down? You know, you buy on the rumors, sell on the news. Is that old hat?
Leo, I'll tell you this. Brian Heater at TechCrunch, every time there's an Apple event, asks me to cover the stock market changes. And every time I start off with, and once again, nothing happened. And I write a whole post about this, and it's an absolute blast. It's become an art project.
Well, yeah, now you have boilerplate. You can just stick it in and you can take the day off.
Right. Then again, you've already written the story, so.
Uh-oh, you're going to get a little red check from the professor over here if you keep that up.
Well, jokes on him, I have a philosophy degree.
I'm trying to think of an example of when Apple has announced or previewed some kind of hardware before they were really ready. Oh, I feel like that's
I'll give you some.
Yeah.
The Mac Pro, both Mac Pros, they've announced 7 months ahead of time. The first iPhone they announced in January didn't ship till June. So here's I think the rule of thumb. If it's something they're selling and it's the new version, they don't want to Osborne it. They don't want to kill the sales of the thing they're selling right now. But when it's a new technology, they do want to get developers in line. And so this would – I think they could announce
They have to have enough, right? They have to have enough of an assurance that what they're telling developers is going to allow the developers to then start thinking and working and prototyping and whatever, right? Like it needs to be far enough along. That's my only thought about it with hardware is,
right.
You know, that's the real difference. You know, I'm somebody who covers software, and the issue with software is you can write a review of somebody's software and then they can come back to you 2 days later and say, well, we fixed it and we changed it. Update your review, please. And that doesn't happen with hardware. Hardware, the most you'll get is maybe a firmware update a few months later addressing some issue. But like hardware really has to be locked down before you can start selling it to people at any level. And software, you have a lot more flexibility.
So if you had a bingo card for tomorrow, would you maybe say, we got a Reality OS, we want you to start, because Apple does have VR technologies for the iPad and the iPhone, and they have a format called USDZ. And so they could say, hey, here's a new toolkit. They do have trademarked the Reality OS. They could say, we're going to ship a beta of Reality OS so you can start playing with it next week. I mean, it's less meaningful without hardware, of course, but...
Yeah, and do you really want to ruin that surprise of here's the new hardware? Here's the thing that we want you to get excited about and buy.
Right.
I think WWDC for me is always so much about the OS update. Right. And for years, we've seen this trend of like, Mac OS is going to be more in sync with iPad OS and iOS or whatever it's called at this point, like kind of getting that convergence together. Like, I think that's been the long journey and I'm expecting to see a whole lot more of that.
That raises a really interesting question too about the Mac OS and the iOS merging. Which way it's going to go in the control sense. And I've been saying for a long time, hoping I'm wrong, that I think Apple is planning to lock down the Mac OS the way it has locked down the portable device OS. And I continue to hope I'm wrong, but you know, a control-freak company with something that's open is kind of a contradiction. And if the more they make one like the other, let's see which subsumes the other. And I know where my bet is.
Mark Gurman in Bloomberg on the 2nd, 3 days ago, said Apple will announce significant changes to the iPad's software this week, making it more actually, Dan, like Mac OS, a redesigned multitasking interface, Windows that can actually overlap other windows, which is something historically the Mac OS iPad OS never wanted to do. That's what Mac OS does. So it may actually be going, we'll see. Well, I agree with you. I'm always afraid of what the lockdown.
But what you've described there is a user interface issue rather than a question of whether they can do that. And if they still don't let you load a Mac OS piece of software, then in fact it's still the iOS just changed.
Right.
I think the decision though to make the iPad a bit more like a laptop computer or more like a desktop environment makes a lot of sense, because I recently bought an iPad Pro and I'm amazed at how I can't do much with it. And
it's essentially the same hardware as an M1 MacBook Air.
Right. And yet it's the software makes it appear to be a very large, stupid iPhone. And like, it's a bummer because as a piece of hardware, it's actually one of the sleekest and best things I've ever purchased.
Yeah. I've said this again and again, this thing's amazing, but the software just doesn't support it.
It's good for chess, I've discovered. I play a lot of chess. I use a lot of chess on
the iPad. Funny you should say that, because I just bought a chess. You can see all the chess crap I have. I just bought an electronic chess board that plugs into it. Oh. And then you play the you load up a game here and it lights up on the chessboard, so you don't have to look at this anymore. And the I know it's stupid.
It's a good thing this is a safe space for nerds, because otherwise you would take a beating
nerd
right now.
Alert. You may be right, Dan. This actually isn't incompatible with your notion that Apple might be locking down Mac OS, because if they make iPad OS more like Mac OS and iPad is really locked down, why not make Mac OS more locked down? My argument against that is that people like you and me who want the Mac to be an open operating system will move to Linux or something.
But Tim Cook has been getting more and more shrill about the dangers of letting people load software that they actually would prefer to use. I mean, he's been yelling and screaming, and Apple leads all industry in fighting against right to repair legislation
And you know why he talks about
that you purchased.
Because he doesn't want the App Store to be unlocked.
Well, it's money. This is money and control, but right. They ought to be at least a little more straightforward about it.
Well, we know it.
I agree.
That's why you and I are never going to Apple campus again.
You know, I have
my invitation anyway.
I have a bunch of Windows and Mac machines in my little home office here. And it's funny, the PC that I install apps on has exploded into flames several times because I picked up apps that I wanted to pick up that Tim Cook didn't approve for me. It's a BS argument. I mean, like the Windows has been open for so long.
As has Android. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. And so to me, I find it sad
bogus.
That
it's self-serving.
Yeah. I'm probably the only one here who uses Linux as my day-to-day operating system, but Microsoft is so envious of Apple. You can see this. And you can also see as they make it harder and harder to do things with Windows 11, like you cannot set up Windows 11 unless you sign into a Microsoft account. Cannot be done. That's a very Apple-like kind of thing.
Yeah. Even Apple doesn't make you do that. You can have a local account on a Mac.
That's true. You still can do that. Yeah. No, just try and do anything after that.
Right. I just got a Dell XPS 15, brand new one. I wanted to take a look at Intel's 12th gen processors because they're trying to compete with the M1 series. And it's Windows 11. And Jill, you may want to weigh in since you're at PC Magazine, but it's Windows is a little you know what? My biggest problem with Windows, it's unpredictable. Now, maybe it's because I don't use it as much as I use Mac and Linux, but things disappear, things close, things don't happen that you expect to have happen. For instance,
I've been editing a lot of stories about Windows 11, and one of our biggest reads has been 10 things I hate about Windows 11.
Oh, no.
Everybody wants to hate on it. Yeah. I mean, you're right, though. I mean, there's a lot of things that are just unpredictable. They change. Why did they change it? There doesn't seem to be a reason. My other big pet peeve with Microsoft is they change the name of something. So just as all the journalists have written the help articles about how to find this feature, how to use it, they change the name. And now you don't know what you're looking for anymore when you go to find help
you
for
have to,
it.
You have to tune into Windows Weekly because Paul Theroux and Mary Jo Foley are tearing their hair out all the time about this. Or then they use one name for 20 things like Outlook. Outlook is a bunch of different things. And when somebody says Outlook, you have to say, well, do you mean the application that comes with Office? Do you mean Outlook.com? It's all these different possibilities.
Yeah, and I give Apple a lot of credit with Mac OS. It's not – Windows is a little bit like having someone show up at your house while you're out at dinner and rearrange the living room and say, you must now keep it in our new arrangement. I don't think Apple does that quite as much as Microsoft does.
Really?
And
right.
On Windows 11, I still can't move the taskbar over to the left where I want the taskbar to be.
I found a setting.
No,
it's buried.
Sorry.
But it's in there.
Can't be done.
Am I the only? Okay, fine. I'll do it. I'll defend Windows. I like it. And I think Mac OS is annoying. And Mac OS is the one when I have stuff disappear and I can't find my files. And also, I have to constantly update it to new versions and it never changes anything. Like Mac OS in my user experience has not changed in like 10 years. And also, Windows 10 is great. There you go. That's my
weak
argument.
You go.
There you go.
But what about Windows 11? Are you using that?
Hell no.
Okay. Well,
Windows is bad.
We found a group of commonality here.
I believe you have until 2025 before you're going to be forced to upgrade. Right. Yeah.
Although they may bug you all the way to the end. I won't go into my litany of complaints. no operating system is perfect. Although, Dan, I'm with you. I think Linux is as close as you can get. And at least no one's telling you what to do when you use it. Let's see. WWDC tomorrow. We'll see iOS 16 previews. We'll see macOS 13, watchOS 9. It is possible they'll announce new MacBook Airs. I think some of the problem is supply chain. When I ordered the Dell in April, they said, well, we think you'll get it in June. Then they made it, and it was manufactured. They said, but because of the lockdown in Shanghai, we're not going to give you a tracking number until it gets to the United States. They literally had no idea what was going to happen to it. And I'm sure Apple, as much as they've been somewhat impervious to the supply chain issues, I mean, I just took a look at ordering a custom-built Mac Studio, and that's 10 to 12 weeks off. So there's still a big supply chain issue going on.
Leo, well, are you excited about iOS 16, macOS 13, watchOS 9?
Who would be? Who could be?
I recently got Chrome 100, I think, and I went,
yeah,
oh,
woo! Let's have a party! The days of, remember Windows, when Windows 95 came out and they had events all over the country? And then, what was it, Windows 7, where they had have your own party? They sent, you could order balloons, playing cards, and invite your friends over. For the new Windows 7, the whole industry has lost that. I think so. Is there anywhere in the industry where people are going, oh my God, this is going to change everything?
Well, games are still exciting to people who are into games. And there's a lot of people who are into games, as their revenues would show.
It's not like there's a new genre. It's like, well, you're going to shoot a gun. What's the gun going to look like? Who's the person you're going to shoot look like? Otherwise, it's the same game. Mm-hmm. Right, Alex?
No, wrong. So you are correct that first-person shooters remain very popular in different iterations. I think games like Apex Legends have actually pushed the ball forward in terms of what that means. But if you play games on a PC,
yes,
you are in the golden era of indie game development.
Okay.
And you're also in the golden era of very complex management games. And so if you
don't love those. You love those ridiculous games that are more like work than they are like play.
Leo, I'm a journalist, and therefore I'm already a masochist. So, like, okay. Bring it on. No, but games like Anno 1800, which is all about supply chain management and so forth, we're living.
That makes me just excited. Whoa.
Ooh, supply chain management. Actually, you know what? I am 600 hours into Valheim, which is an indie game that is really quite fun and has a lot of building and stuff. So I'm with you. There's some really interesting stuff being done.
Yeah.
But we are at peak technology in almost every area, frankly. Let's face it. Let's take another quick break. We've got court action coming up next on Twit. Really great to have Alex Wilhelm here, TechCrunch Plu. That's what I'm going to call it from now on. I hope you don't mind.
Would it matter if I did?
I think I stopped getting people from Bloomberg Business Week because I insisted on calling it Bloomberg Business Week. So I'll be nice because I want you to keep coming back. Jill Duffy, it's great to have you back. It's been way, way too long. PC Magazine. So nice to see you. And of course, from the Walter Cronkite School. Okay. It's Dan Gilmore. That's the way it is. We are going to take a little break, come back with lots more of our experts.
You sounded like Nixon. Sorry.
I did. I'm sorry. My Cronkite turns into Nixon. I'm working on it.
It was all the smoking back then, I think.
We'll be back in just a second. Our show today brought to you by Podium. I love Podium. In fact, a lot of our small businesses around town have started to use Podium. You know, if you own a small business, the last few years have been, believe me, I know, tough, really tough. Supply chain issues, you can't get the stuff, and then all of a sudden the demand is up, and if you could get it, you could sell it, but you can't get it. And on top of anything, everything else you're trying to manage, the businesses that are thriving right now are the ones who are a little more forward-thinking. And that means using text messaging, using Podium. Podium helps your small business stay ahead of the curve with modern messaging tools that your customers actually want. It makes it easier for them to connect with your business. And a lot of people these days, for instance, don't like to call. Are you one of those? I don't want to call. But what the pandemic taught us is, hey, we can text businesses. They can text us back, say your order is on the way. If you want to get a bid, I did this the other day. It was incredible. A window broke at our house. I texted instead of calling because I wants to call 20 different window repair people, glaziers, they call themselves. So I texted them. And you know who got the job? The first one that texted back, probably using Podium, right? 100,000 businesses from healthcare providers to plumbers are texting with customers through Podium. Customers love the convenience. Businesses love the results. Podium's giving businesses the tools they need to compete with the convenience offered by, you know, Amazon. How do you compete as a small business with Amazon? Personal service, Podium. It's really that simple. A dentist who sent out payment requests. He was, you know, as often happens, a lot of people forgot to pay. They hadn't paid. He decided to send out texts. 70% of the outstanding collections got collected in 2 weeks. Just like that. Because, you know, people open texts, they respond to texts. It's more personal. It's more direct. It's faster. You can ask people to leave a review for you. You can sell things. A dealer sold a $50,000 truck in 4 text messages. The negotiations are fast. They're easy. Customer's happy. You're happy. With Podium's all-in-one inbox, you can do a lot more than just chat with people. You can ask for reviews. If somebody leaves the store, you say, how was your experience? Leave us a review on Yelp or Google or wherever you like your reviews. And I have to tell you, when a customer gets that and you're fresh in their mind, they respond more quickly. They leave you a more accurate review. You can collect payments fast from anywhere. You can do marketing campaigns. The ice cream parlor downtown, I went there couple of times, gave them my phone number. Now every three or four weeks, I get a text saying, hey, we miss you. We got a special on ice cream right now. That's the last thing I need, but it really works. It really does. And it's all in a text message. It's quick. It's fast. It's better for you. Your employees love it because of that single inbox, and your customers, most importantly, your customers love it and respond. See how Podium can grow your business. Watch a demo today. It's easy. You can try it for free. Podium.com/twit. Podium.com/twit. Podium. Let's grow. All right. Now let's get back to the show. Back we are with our esteemed panel as we take a look at the week's news. You might notice there's a slight difference in the way this show looks and sounds. That's because we had a calamity at the factory. I think the entire supply chain collapsed. Alex, maybe we can bring you in. You can solve our supply chain woes. We had a power outage overnight, and not everything came back as it should have.
I'm least qualified to help with your IT setup.
No one is. I got all the engineers going, I don't know. We rebooted everything. Everything lights are coming on, but nothing's happening. So I'm doing this from home. We're using Zoom. Thank God Zoom has gotten – when I first started Twit, we used Skype with 4 people, and I would spend hours after the show fixing audio, and this is, I think, actually pretty good. And everybody's used to Zooming now, right? Jill's written a book about it, actually. What is it called?
I got to say, the Everything Guide to Remote Work, wherever you buy physical books and ebooks. I got to say, you know, I am really, really proud of this book. And it is truly a guide where you can pick it up and flip to the chapter that you need. So if you're like, I'm having a bad day, and I need to shake up my work from home routine. Like, what can I do differently in my environment? What can I do differently with how I communicate and collaborate with people? Or I'm a manager and I need to figure out what are some tricks to like get my team to be cohesive again.
Nice.
Pick it up, flip to what you want. I have these really fun little tabs that are birds. I don't know if you can see those. Look at that.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Little page tags.
That doesn't come with the book, right? That's purchased separately.
No, you've got to go get those from a fancy Japanese paper store.
Very. I love that. I'm always looking for good bookmarks. That's pretty retro, isn't it? But 3 out of 4 panelists today have bookshelves behind them. So I guess we are a retro bunch. Maybe I should have purchased your book before this calamity. I'm still trying to figure out how Zoom works.
Yeah. So back to Zoom, I wrote about Zoom. You know, it was really like this darling of the tech industry and a lot of remote companies before anybody else had really heard of it and picked it up. And I came to PC Mag and I was like, you guys, we really need a review of Zoom. It's going to be a big thing. Pandemic? This was probably 2017, 2018. Wow. And I knew a little bit about the company, and the real point of differentiation was from the very beginning, they said, let's not think too much about features and bells and whistles. Let's focus on getting the back end technology good so it's stable. Because at that point in time, there were so many video conferencing solutions. And the problem with all of them was they were so glitchy. Yeah. And so I think if you compare it then at that point in time, 2015, 2016, to everything else that was available, it was just so much more stable. And I think that's what really sold it when people realized we need to have meetings online a lot more. We can't have something that's just going to crap out all the time.
That really answers a question. I don't know if we ever got an answer to why during the pandemic, Zoom took off, and FaceTime and Duo and Skype and all, and Teams.
Microsoft Teams.
Why did they couldn't they capitalize? Do you think it was just simply quality? Or
I think a lot of it really was the quality. And also that out of the gate, they had a very generous free offering for a long time. So it's no longer this way. But when the pandemic hit,
I still have a lot of 40-minute Zoom calls because people don't pay for it. And so they go. Oh,
although, isn't that brilliant? Yes. If you have a multi-person call, 40 minutes is the limit. Like, that's great. But at the time, you could have a one-on-one call that could be as long as you wanted. So no restrictions on that. And a lot of people relied on that and used it because it was just more stable than anything else.
It was a lifesaver. I mean, you know, if we hadn't had Zoom, life would have been a lot harder.
And the company is not without its controversy. You know, there was a big problem with Zoom bombing, which, you know, I have to say, I think I got it wrong in the beginning. When I heard about that, I said, well, people really need to be educated and turned on the correct features to prevent people from getting in. And that was the wrong take. The company really needs to make sure that it's taking proactive measures for people to have the protections that they need to keep their meetings secure from the beginning. And for me, that was a good sort of thought process to go through to think about what is the company's responsibility to you as a consumer. And then some other things they got wrong too, where they announced that they were going to charge people for one thing and not another, and what was going to be encrypted and what wasn't. So they've been through the ringer a bit, and that's good. You know, the more people use the tool, the more emphasis and light you shine onto their user agreements and their policies and their procedures, and the more it really pushes the company to get it right.
I mean, there was a lot of discussion on our network, especially in the security shows, about their lack of end-to-end encryption. They, you know, they said it's end-to-end encrypted, but it wasn't. They were very aggressive about hiring contractors. They didn't hire them as staff, but they hired good people. They acquired Keybase, which is a really good encryption firm, and some very good engineers there. So obviously, they were smart. They took the money that they – their windfall profits from the pandemic, and they put them, in the right places. And at this point, you know, we use Skype for most of Twit's life. We switched to Zoom about a year ago, and at this point – there is nothing that comes even close. In fact, thank goodness we did, because we actually have a show today, which we might not if we hadn't had Zoom.
Leo, you were the last reason I still had Skype on any computer. So thank you.
I know. I apologize to all of you who are forced to keep Skype on your computer so you can do Twit. I am so sorry. You can now erase it. You don't need it anymore.
Yeah, my machine breathed a big sigh of relief when I uninstalled it. The Google product, I don't know, they keep changing names.
Well, there is a big change.
Google Meet, I think, was what it's called now. That's become pretty good.
We use it for our business meetings, for safety meetings and stuff like that.
I'm on a major mass project that we're people are using that. And I still, in many ways, prefer Zoom, but it did force the big companies to pay attention instead of saying, "Well, that's just one more feature you can use or not use." They did upgrade it a lot. I like Zoom partly because it's not Microsoft or Google or Facebook or Apple. I want to keep supporting stuff that's not one of the big ones.
I am starting to feel some Zoom fatigue. So that is definitely a real thing for being forced to look. See, it's funny when I'm in a studio, it's not quite the same. But when you're on a call, you kind of be forced to look at people and stuff like that. And it's an interesting shift. Actually, there is a meeting is in the news, Google Meet, because Google is unbelievably, although by now we should expect this, once again changing their messaging strategy. They have a product which I have used, which is much like FaceTime or Zoom or Skype. It's called Duo. I use it with my daughter who has an Android phone. It works great, has a lot of some interesting features that others don't have. They've announced that they're going to merge Duo and Meet so that everybody will be confused and nobody will be happy. I guess in theory, it could be an improvement to Meet because of the core technology of Duo, which is very, very, very good for video.
You used the expression Google messaging strategy. I think.
Is that an oxymoron?
Yeah, I don't think there is such a thing.
Google messaging chaos is what it really feels
Google's
like.
Google's messaging chaos. Yeah. So get ready. If you're using Meet, it's kind of unclear to me, but it sounds like Google's going to, I don't know what they're, merge Duo into it. They're eventually phasing out the name Duo, but phasing Meet into Duo. So really, Meet will be Duo with Meet features.
And this is, I mean, the same thing just happened with Google Chat and Google Message, Google Voice, Hangouts, Google Hangout.
Meet and
it's like they hired somebody from Microsoft to handle their namings.
Oh no.
But going back to the Sheryl Sandberg conversation, when Paige and Brin left and Eric left, Google did start to turn into this kind of less well-run. And Sundar Pichai has not, I don't think, been a very good CEO. We've talked about this on the show before. I'm sure he's technically good. But the leadership, there's a leadership void at Alphabet. I guess I should call it Alphabet. And the problem is they get away with it because they make, and this is going to be the same problem with Facebook, so much money. You're nodding, Alex, on advertising, right?
Yeah. But I mean, at the same problem comes up, though. We talked about the crapification of social networks earlier and how Instagram's being essentially been forced to take on more and more of the revenue growth at Facebook. Google search is a mess.
Yeah.
Google search is a hot mess.
It's getting more like Instagram.
Well, it's getting like when I search for a term, most of the time I want the Wikipedia page. Right. And now on mobile, I have to scroll through like blocks of suggested alternative searches. Like screw you, Google. I literally knew what I typed. Thanks. And then there's ads, and then there's so much more sponsor content. It's just miserable. And they're just wringing that rag because nothing else they've ever done makes money. And I'm just going to go back to what Jill said about Microsoft. At least they have more than one business line. You know, right. Apple has iPhone, Facebook has human misery, Google has not results. At least Microsoft sells more than one thing. Now, company has problems, to be clear, but at least they can do more than one thing.
Yeah, remember.
You know, what you're saying about Google, I think another issue that a lot of us as journalists and writers know from the back end is that Google changes how it surfaces information all the time. And I think so many online publications have just come to rely on Google so much for feeding their traffic. And it is impossible to know how these changes come about, when they take place, when they're being rolled out, how do you make your content optimized? It's really hard, and it doesn't seem like a good long-term solution for people to get information. It's just seems like it's getting worse.
Well, we got to solve that because, I mean, isn't that the whole thing? I mean, this if the internet didn't have Google, I don't know if we'd have an internet.
Yeah. It goes back to what Dan said about platforms,
using
though.
Bing.
Well, Bing is fine. It's not amazing. It has the same problems that Google does. But Dan was talking earlier about getting off platforms, controlling your own media, going back to the era of blogging. That brings the source of information back to an individual versus Google's magical algorithm. Right. And it would, you know, if that did ever happen, you know, I don't want to dream about something that might be get crushed, but like at least it would remove some of the dominance from Google's prominence and information centrality, which is a really boring way of saying that. Sorry, I could have said that simpler.
But, yeah, but you can't find those blogs without Google unless we bring back, I don't know, Bloggerati or whatever it was. Technorati.
Technorati.
Right? We have to have blog search again. One thing that is coming back, Twitter seems to – so way back when – I think this must have been 2009 or 10. Twitter had a feature that was great called Tracker. It was kind of like a Google alert where you could say, I want to see any tweets about a certain subject. It was hugely valuable. And I remember very well something they called Bear Hug Camp. I think your brother was involved in this, Dan, actually, where we were trying to get Twitter to bring back Tracker. They never did, except they just – it's I don't know if it's a rumor or an announcement. They're going to bring back basically search indexing search terms, alerts, Tracker. So maybe Twitter is the hope for all.
Well, you can do a lot of that with keyword searches now, and you can
– But this would alert you. So yeah. Like if you wanted to be alerted – when something happened, it was a very useful tool.
Mm. Yeah, I don't even remember that.
Nobody does. Yeah, it was way in the dim, dark ages of blogs and podcasts.
Oh man!
So speaking of, I said we were going to talk about the courts. This, I'll see if I can make my way through this without completely confusing myself. Florida and Texas both passed social media laws that attempt to force large social media companies not to censor Donald Trump. Let's face it. That's really what it was. But they couldn't say that. So not to censor conservative. They couldn't say that. So not to censor. But it of course, is a pretty clear violation of the First Amendment, which says government shall make no law abridging speech. And that speech, if you say, I don't want that on my Twitter feed, or I don't want that on Facebook, that speech. So weirdly, the Texas law there was an immediate attempt for request for injunctive relief by social networks who said, wait a minute, you know, you can't make that the law yet. Let's sue. So they sued and they said, and they asked the judge, okay, look, stop the law. The judge said, yes. Then the state of Texas appeals to the Fifth Circuit, which says, no, that's a good law. And they said, okay, we're waiting. That's currently the state. It's legal in Texas. No, wait a minute. No, because then they appealed again in the Supreme Court. And by the way, I thought this would not happen because Justice Alito is the guy who manages the shadow docket for the Fifth Circuit. So I thought Alito would just say, no. But no, in fact, weirdly, the Supreme Court actually voted on this. They didn't put out a decision. There was a dissent from some of the justices. So it's now blocked. The Florida bill, also blocked by a lower court, by the 11th Circuit, that has not yet been appealed to the Supreme Court. So as it stands, neither one of these weird laws are in effect, although court cases will continue in both cases. Did I get that right?
Close enough.
You did. And the Supreme Court semi-decision. You can't call it a since this is going to come back in a appeal again about the actual law as opposed to the injunction. What fascinated me was that the vote there was 5-4.
Yes.
And
who was on the dissent and who was on the affirm?
And I'm assuming because again, it was really about whether an injunction was timely or whether this thing should be let stand for now, that I'm assuming that most of the ones who dissented will actually vote that it's unconstitutional when it gets back, with that being the issue, because Kagan was one of the ones who said, let it ride for now. And that's baffled me.
She was the lone liberal you would expect. But Justice Roberts and I think it was Kavanaugh and Barrett voted to uphold to reverse the Fifth Circuit's decision and to block the law.
Right.
Kagan voted to allow it.
I think perhaps I don't know. You can't read their minds, but it seems likely to me that this will be fairly resoundingly found unconstitutional.
One would assume, yeah.
When it gets back. But we have a Supreme Court now that's becoming more and more visibly a tool of the Republican Party. And that is somewhat alarming because the Republican Party is clearly not that interested in free speech per se. It's interested in free speech for people it agrees with and who agree and are part of an agenda. And there are several justices who would vote to overturn one of the most important cases ever, the Brandenburg case, that requires malice when talking about a public figure as a standard for libel. And that's really dangerous. But things are changing faster than we all seem to be paying enough attention to.
Yeah, it seems the First Amendment would protect these social networks. Somebody pointed out that if this, I think Mike Masnick on Techter pointed out, if this Texas law had stood, for instance, Twitch might not have been able to pull down the Buffalo shooter's live stream. And if it did, it would risk lawsuit because that's what the law establishes is the right to sue.
The Texas law did have quite a laundry list of carve outs. I think Amazon would have been totally fine pulling that down, even if that law had been found constitutional.
Okay.
Nobody
wants that to be, you know.
Well, it's still a bad law, but when you read it, you see that it wasn't done completely without thought. Mostly, perhaps, without thought.
Yeah, it's like giving someone like half the antiseptic they need before they cut off their leg. It's like, oh, well, you made an effort. Good job. You're something like a gangrene and die. I think it's ridiculous that we're at the point where we're arguing that the government should force private actors to carry speech and disseminate it. Like, how did we end up in this freaking – sorry, not swearing on Twitter takes so much effort. It's just like this like whole soul.
Well, I hate to tell you, but I can't bleep you right now, so – have at it.
No, the people who produce Twit do not deserve me to make their life harder. But I'm just saying
they're just
going
to have to work harder. That's all.
No, I've met them. I love those guys. I just can't believe we're here. It's like I'm living in cartoon land or upside down world. Like, what the hell is this? This is just essentially two different governors, each gunning for the future atop a political party that is neo-fascist, arguing about how they should be given more power over corporations to determine what is speech.
It's really performative. I think both Abbott and DeSantis are smart enough to know that it doesn't stand the sniff test for the First Amendment, but it's certainly a performative. I mean, it certainly establishes their bona fides in terms of protecting conservative speech, right?
Yeah, and it also establishes their bona fides in my brain as morons. Like, I mean, I'm not interested in performative governance. Call me a technocrat.
Now I'm
going to
get more emails from people who say, you never let conservative people on the show. Alex is just a crazy liberal lefty out of Rhode Island, which is a hotbed of crazy liberal lefties.
I wish we weren't using the word conservative to describe extremists.
I'll grant you that. Yeah.
It's a common misnomer at this point. We all use it, and I think it's wrong.
It's protective cover for them.
Yeah,
because they're the opposite of conservative.
Yes, they're neo-fascist and essentially monarchist. They want to give Donald Trump the country and let him sit there and hold on to it because they don't actually believe in democracy. And to me, that's disgusting and anti-American and should be called out as such. And if you want to find someone who will come and argue the First Amendment does allow the government to compel corporations to cover speech they don't agree with or don't want to disseminate, bring them on. Good luck finding that person who's serious.
Elon might come on. Elon... Twitter said on Friday this is going to be our brief mention of Elon. We've been trying to. We're on an Elon diet. Twitter said on Friday. Sorry, I didn't see you drinking. I wouldn't have said that. Said on Friday, the waiting period under the Hart. I love saying it. Hart-Scott-Rodino Antitrust Improvements Act has expired, which means Elon, where's your check for $44 billion? No, well, I guess Twitter's next step is to go to the shareholders and say, do you want to get $54.20 for this stock that's selling at $38? Alex, why is Twitter's stock so low? Shouldn't it be closer to $54.20?
The gap between the proposed deal price and the current share price just shows the market's lack of belief that it will get closed at that level. He has been again, editing crap posting all over Twitter about the deal, the company, the management, its user base, and so forth. Are they in an attempt to break up with the company and get out of the deal? And there's legal issues there and some fines and so forth.
He may not be able to. Well, it's not just the $1 billion, what do you call
breakup
it?
Breakup fee.
Breakup fee. It's, he may be compelled. He signed. It's like you said, I'm going to buy a car. You know, you sign on the dotted line. You can't decide not to.
Or he's trying to lower the price. And that seems to be what investors are betting on. But I don't think Twitter didn't want to sell.
Yeah.
They adopted a poison pill defense to dilute ownership to avoid this.
Right.
Then they got kind of bullied into it. And now the guy who bullied them is walking away because he's a coward. Weird.
Meanwhile, it's
I think it was a bluff from the start. I really do think it was a bluff from the start. And if you look at anybody else who is a high-powered bleepity-bleep, the next step is to litigate, right? Like that's how you get out of it is you threaten a lawsuit, you bring a lawsuit, you
settle a lawsuit.
You settle a lawsuit.
But I have
exactly.
to say Elon has done things which are not good for Tesla to raise the money. He's been actively kind of trying to get the money together. If he didn't mean to buy it, I don't know, would he be doing that?
He probably thought that he could leverage Tesla stock forever, that it would continue to go up. Tesla's stock price has been insane, and not in the crazy Eddie sense, but I mean in the ridiculous sense for a really long time.
Right. Twitter is now $40 as we record this. So that's a $14.20 differential. That's a pretty significant differential. If you thought he was going to be forced to sell it or buy it at $54.20, it might be a good buy, right?
Can we also kill off the annoying thing about putting meme numbers into deal values, like 420? Like, I mean, cents department. Like, are we run by children?
That confirms Jill's theory that he didn't mean it. Because why would you bid something 54-20?
You know, I think there's people who have a lot of power and not a lot of clarity of thought anymore who don't always know that they are bluffing, right? Like there's a moment at which you believe what you're saying,
right,
but you don't really think you're going to be held to it. And when you're called out on it, you double down, but you still know you have all this money and a galley of lawyers to back you up to help you get out of it in the end. And you know, I'm not saying people do this with the conscious thought, but you see it happen a whole lot.
I just started watching the WeWork documentary with Jared Leto and Anne Hathaway. And Jared Leto is embodying Adam Neumann's absolute faith and willingness to lie up and down, but believe it, because his fundamental faith is if you believe it hard enough, it will happen. And I'm sure Elon Musk has that same mentality. A lot of startup founders do, right?
Yeah, well, I think we've all known founders who acted like, you know, Dorothy in Oz trying to get home. And just, you know, if you believe it, it'll happen is faith. And we don't, it's really tough because we, in this business that we're all so steeped in, a lot of things have happened because people didn't give up when no sense to continue.
There's a lot of examples, yeah.
But I think we've also, and I fault myself on this considerably. I think I've tended to give people, cut people slack at times when I should not have, when I've said, well, it could, maybe it could happen, when it was sort of observably ridiculous right. from the start. And the whole tech journalism industry basically got taken in more than once by that were false.
Yeah. We're complicit. We try not to be. I think we all try not to be. We all try to be hard-headed. I don't know. I kind of want it to work. I think this would be cool if VR, if the metaverse existed, or, you know, if we all were in self-driving vehicles. And sometimes we forget there's some barriers, some real technical barriers to that. Tesla is actually pausing all hiring worldwide. They're going to cut 10% of their staff amid Elon's memo. Elon did not buy your book, Jill. Elon's memo saying, if you want to work here, you're going to come back to the office. Wow. I'm sure you read that, Jill.
Yeah, minimum 40 hours a week in an office.
Minimum. And he says, American. And I mean yeah. minimum.
Yeah.
Wow. This is less than we ask of factory workers. And then he sent another email because I guess people, I don't know, maybe he thought people weren't taking him seriously. The more senior you are, the more visible must be your presence. That's why I lived in the factory so much. I thought it was to annoy the workers. What did I know? Yeah. So that those on the line could see me working alongside them. I've seen posts from a number of anonymous Tesla engineers who said, yeah, he was there. He has no engineering expertise. So he was just micromanaging us and making it harder to get our job done. So thank you, Elon. He said, if I hadn't done that, Tesla would long ago have been bankrupt. Now maybe I should bring in the
He certainly knows how to get some spotlight on him, right? Like,
yeah.
Say something that's controversial, say it loudly, make a big bluster over it. That's how you get people to pay attention, even if you're wrong. I mean, isn't this what's wrong with social media is...
Right.
Is that's the way to get the attention. That's the way to get the clicks and the views and the YouTube plays and the follows.
Well, right.
It really is.
You
and
know,
it's,
if you're a Kardashian, you don't have to do anything important. You just have to be on TV.
And say something that people don't like.
Right.
He's got some, I mean, genuine, amazing accomplishments to his record. And I don't want to dismiss those. I mean, we would not be as far as we are in electrification of automobiles and vehicles as we are today. We would not be there had it not been for Tesla. We would get there, and on space travel, I'm hats off to SpaceX. Although so much of SpaceX has been funded by us taxpayers.
As That's true of Tesla too.
Genius entrepreneurship, but
you pay back those loans. So.
And Tesla gets the benefit of enormous tax breaks for its customers, et cetera, et cetera. Having said that, I'm having to separate the admiration I have for the vision at some level, and the fortitude to push through trouble and to make things actually happen with a great team. And all of the BS and the some of the vile stuff that he represents that really bothers me a lot. And I come out on the sort of, well, I admire the accomplishments, but really, really can't stand the person as a leader of people.
I drove a Tesla. I was very happy to drive a Tesla. I really did want, you know, and I still drive electric vehicles. We all do in our family. I know. I've also read articles from people who say, you know, a lot of it's bluster. He's certainly, for the last 7 years, been telling us we'd have self-driving vehicles next year. I don't know if that's ever going to happen. SpaceX, yeah, pretty impressive, thanks to a lot of government money. But still, they're doing okay. And that, now I'm starting to see some Starlink dissatisfaction as they raise the prices. And the quality seems to be deteriorating. So he likes to promise. Go ahead, Alex. I could tell you want to say something.
I just want to go back to the whole working from the office thing. Forget. I mean, Dan did a good job going over the accomplishments and the issues and controversies.
Give him credit.
I used to work 50-50 between a home office on the East Coast and an office on the West Coast. I would just fly back and forth. And so I had infinite natural experiments between the two working environments. Same job, just in different places. I would do work for 2 weeks, and then I would fly to the office for 2 weeks to be annoyed by people who wanted to talk to me at the coffee machine. And like, I'm just perplexed by this idea
Go for lunch today, Alex?
I mean, you joke, but yes. And just walking, like, and the time spent commuting and the executive function of my brain that I had to waste just getting around San Francisco. Love the city, by the way. To me, this is just insanity that people are saying you're less productive. I do understand that certain jobs will have a higher office component, sales teams, people who build stuff, sure. But for most of us who go to an office, sit down and put on headphones, what are you doing? And so I'm just, for someone who's theoretically so visionary, and when
SpaceX we're all working landed, from home right now, aren't we? Even me.
We're working from home on a Sunday.
On a Sunday.
Yeah.
Thank you. You guys are great. Jill Duffy, Alex Wilhelm. It's great to have you. Dan Gilmore. We're going to take a little break, come back, and lots more to talk about on TWiT. Hey, before we go on, I want to show you my new jacket. Wait a minute. Let's take it off. My dresser is here. Hand me the jacket. Thank you, Lisa. Wait a minute. Look at that. Look at that lining. I got this. I wasn't going to show anybody. I've been mentioning it, but I got this for the cruise because, you know, they have these formal nights. But who wants to wear a tuxedo? So I went to Indochino and I got an amazing set. My whole wardrobe for the cruise is from Indochino. Look at this. Isn't that beautiful? Oh my God. And you know what? This is the first time I've worn it, but I knew it would fit. You know why? Indochino, you send them their measurements and it's like getting a tailor. It is a tailor. They make it to your measurements. No XL, XXL, small, medium. This is to match my exact dimensions. I love Indochino. If you've got a wedding coming up, it's the month of weddings. If you're going to be a groom or maybe in the groom's party, if you're going to the wedding, you want to look good, get a custom fit suit from Indochino. You will look great. You will feel confident. You'll enjoy the big day and you won't fuss over your clothes. The nice thing about Indochino, and you know, this, because it fits so well, the nice thing about it is it's comfortable. So I don't know if when you get dressed up, sometimes you go, I feel just a little weird, a little uncomfortable. Not with Indochino, because it's like it fits you like a glove. It's beautiful. And you know what? You get it to match your total needs and desires. You could choose every detail on the suit. They make shirts, dinner jackets. The prices are remarkable, much more affordable than you would expect for custom tailored pieces. Look, you can even, you know, you could choose the buttons. You could look at this. You could choose fun linings. I thought I'd choose the purple polka dots. I love this. Is a, for those of you listening, I look like James Bond in my purple velvet suit with satin lapels. Best part is Indochino suits start from just $429, shirts from just $79. These are tailored, custom fitted. They also have casual wear. Get a wardrobe personalized to your style and taste without spending a fortune. And they're always adding new pieces, new options. So you can, it's fun to shop at Indochino. And you know, once they have your measurements, man, you know everything you order is going to fit perfectly. The things we ordered, everything fits just right. If you've got a big day coming up, getting the perfect look, whoo, no big deal. With Indochino.
Indochino.com.
I look sharp, don't I? $50 off any purchase of $3.99 or more right now. When you use the promo code TWIT, go to Indochino.com. $50 off any purchase of $3.99 or more. Indochino.com. Promo code TWIT. It's a little warm, though, so I will take it off for the rest of the show. We're going to hang it up nicely. And if you're coming on the TWIT cruise with us, cruise.twit.tv, to Alaska next month, expect James Bond in a purple velvet suit or something like that. All right, back to the show we go. We're back. Special edition of TWIT. The sweaty Leo stays home edition. I just want to set the record straight. I'm not here because I have COVID. I'm here because the studio fell apart basically overnight. And so, but you know what? In a way, this is kind of, I like this. This is more like us just sitting around talking. This is how TWIT started way back in the day. And I'm really glad you're here, Jill Duffy. We're going to talk about the 40th anniversary of PC Magazine in just a little bit. That's amazing. Dan Gilmore, who's of course the dean of journalism. So he's going to be our conscience today for and of course, I've known Dan for years since the San Jose Mercury News. Alex Wilhelm, also dear friend from TechCrunch. New York State passes. I was stunned to see this headline. First ever right to repair law. I thought there were dozens of states working on right to repair laws. I remember talking about how Apple was going to one state government somewhere in the Midwest saying, oh, you can't let people repair their stuff. I thought for sure we'd have a right to repair law. There's the righttorepair.org, Kyle Wiens and iFixus's website to push this. And yet, this is it, the first actual right to repair law. I guess what the upshot is, if you do it in New York, they're big enough that probably every company would have to respond, right? New York says all manufacturers who sell digital electronic products in the state of New York will have to make tools and manuals, instructions available, parts too, for people, consumers and independent shops that want to repair their stuff. The measure won't take effect for another year. So once the Governor Hochul signs it, it'll be a year. But iFixit said it's one giant leap for repair kind.
Good news, it's so right? important for environmentalism, too.
Yes.
You know, we live in this in a society where we are really pushed to consume, consume, consume. Companies, corporations have to grow, grow, grow. Like, anybody who has an environmental conscience will see that that is not the right way to do anything. And a better way is to have devices that last a long time, that we can fix, that we can repair, that we can use those parts over and over again. And this is just too long coming. Super happy to see it, though.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for the governor to sign it before I break out in cheers. And it's worth noting California blocked it, the same kind of law in the last few days.
Due to lobbying.
Well, the industry that wants to make sure that you don't own what you purchased, that they continue to own what you purchased, is very effective at blocking common sense laws like this. And increasingly, this is evil that they're blocking these laws. Just evil.
I agree.
Well said. 100%.
Yeah.
President Biden issued an executive order asking the FTC to enforce these repair rights. I don't know how much teeth that had. Technically, I should clarify that New York State's the first electronics law. There have been previous laws. A Massachusetts law focused on automobile data. You have the right to repair your data? I don't know. And Colorado,
right, your data.
I'm reading The Verge's article. The Colorado passed a bill ensuring, and this is wild, the right to repair powered wheelchairs. This was a big controversy because people were waiting months to get their only form of transportation fixed because the manufacturer said, no, 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 we can't let you fix this.
It's the John Deere story in a different way. John Deere refusing to let people fix their own tractors. And the Massachusetts law, I believe, was it was about the diagnostic things you plugged into.
The OBD.
They had to open that up. So what did the auto manufacturers do? They made it mobile and wireless, which negated the law. They're, you know, listen, industry, and I remember this is led by Apple. Apple is the primary company that runs around spending lots of money on lobbying and other things to prevent this kind of law from passing. Everyone else is in on it, but Apple is the leader in blocking right to repair.
Which is funny amazing. Because I don't even understand this. They do now have a self-repair plan. We actually, Micah Sargent ordered a phone battery for his iPhone 12. He didn't need to repair it, but we wanted to test it. Got the 76 pounds, the two big Pelican cases. They arrived. The clock starts ticking the minute they arrive. You have 7 days to return it or you have to pay thousands of dollars for the equipment. The battery didn't come. It was shipped separately because it's lithium ion. 2 hours before the 7-day deadline, they arrive. Mike is calling Apple, and it turns out Apple doesn't do this. A company called Spot is doing it for Apple. He calls Spot. They say, no extension. You didn't get the battery. Not our problem. send it back. So we now have a battery and no way to repair it. And then on top of all of that, I mean, Apple's, you know, it's malicious compliance. They're adhering to the letter of the law without actually giving you something you can use. And on top of that, the cost ends up being about the same as bringing it to an Apple store. So, and it's only for the latest iPhone SE, iPhone 12 and iPhone 13. It's not for older stuff. So
it's the way Microsoft vowed to comply in back in the old days when it was ordered to remove Internet Explorer from the operating system. And they said, fine, we'll just disable the operating system. Because, of course, this is all hairball that you cannot remove one part of without destroying everything. Right. I remember writing about that and saying this was compliance with a raised middle finger.
It's like paying a fine in pennies, you know, 50,000 pennies. Here's another, I think, good law. Jill, you might have something to say about this. It's not passed in the U.S. It's the province of Ontario has passed a right to disconnect, a right to disconnect law. As of June 2nd, employers in Ontario with 25 or more employees have to have a written policy on disconnecting outside business hours. That means no work-related communications, no emails, no telephone calls, no video calls, no sending or reviewing of messages, no performance of work when you're off duty. You wouldn't think you'd need a law to do that, but you do.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about this is I think there's been a really strange shift generationally as younger people have come into the workforce. This is before the pandemic. There was a piece of research done that asked people about how much they wanted to be connected to their jobs when they were on vacation, nights, weekends, whatever their time off was. And younger people said, I feel like I want to be connected so that I don't come back to panic and chaos and unexpected things. Right. I'm used to being connected to people. I'm used to know what's going on. And now I think there's a caveat there, which is to say younger people who are inexperienced and may have been led into believing you are so important to your company, you're so valuable, the company will love you back. You know, there might be a little bit of disillusionment there about what it means to be connected. But they sort of had a very different understanding of why they wanted to still be connected in their time off. And it didn't mean they wanted to be working. It just, they didn't want to have any surprises come up while they were away and have this like, you know, very strange fear of missing out. Whereas older workers sort of said, I don't want to be looking at email on the weekend. I don't want to be getting text messages when I'm on vacation. I want to be able to disconnect. So I think, you know, on the one hand, it is good for people to feel like they have some agency and some, choice in how much they want to be connected with their employer. But there is the problem that not everybody knows what that really means, and they don't have the experience to understand why it could be problematic.
Yeah. Well, they will. They'll get the Sheryl Sandberg burnout. I hope her next book is not Lean In, it's Burned Out or something like that. There is definitely, we talked about it earlier, this kind of notion, the notion of the founder and working 60 hours and, you know, losing your wife, your kids, your family life, your regular life, because you're building something that's going to change the world. And I guess if you had stock options, you might say, I'm also, you know, building my future. But otherwise, really, you're just building up the pocketbook of the guy who owns the company.
You know, in media, we have layoffs every couple of years. It's just sort of like a routine thing that happens.
Yeah.
I got laid off in my 20s, and maybe it was the best thing that ever happened to me in terms of having a better understanding of what my self-worth and my identity is in connection with my job. At the time, it was awful. I had to go through a grieving process. It was really painful because I felt like this was so important to me, and I was really pouring my all, and I wanted to be important to this publication that I worked on. And with some years of hindsight, it really was a big shift for me, and I'm glad it happened.
I'm going to take Well, I mean, Leo doesn't know this yet, but my spouse and I are—well, she's pregnant. I'm just part of it.
Congratulations!
We just hit 12 weeks, so I'm kind of legal.
You can say it now.
Yeah, I can say it now.
Second trimester. That's the best, by the way.
Well, I'm just glad my spouse is more interested in eating food now that she can.
That's great.
I bring it up, though, because I'm going to take paternity leave, mostly in Q1. You know, my spouse asked me, you know, how much time can you take off? And I said, I don't know, but I'm taking off a lot. And she says, well, what if they say no? And I said, well,
FMLA.
No, more like eat excrement and expire. Like, I'm not going to miss these months because of a job.
You don't have to say that yet. They haven't said no yet.
No. But she brought up the, you know,
that's the priority. And that should be your priority. It's crazy in this country that especially paternity leave is not the law of the land. I mean, every other civilized country gives you a lot of time off. It's insane.
Yeah, I would like to very gently suggest parental leave other than paternity leave.
Well, he'd be parental leave. Yeah, parental. Yeah, but my point being that I think a lot of companies have a maternal leave policy and they don't have a paternal leave policy. I agree. Parental leave is very important, but sometimes fathers are left out of that equation. They go, well, you didn't do anything. Come back to work. What are you doing there? You
know, taking care of the new life that just came into this earth. And is
that's a little more important than writing. Oh, no, I'm not going to do it. I don't want to get in trouble.
Hey, let's not diminish
writing the day of the WWC Apple stock price story. That's a good story. It's a valuable story.
It's not. It takes 7 minutes. It's an absolute. It's fun.
You can do that in the waiting room.
Is Arrington listening to this? The 7 minutes.
Oh, he isn't there anymore. He's long gone.
Dan, I can type really fast. So.
You know, you talk about this civilized countries. I mean, when you put that in the context of the United States, this is getting more and more of a problematic notion in all kinds of ways, not least of which that we don't have health care for people.
We don't have health care. Exactly.
You want entrepreneurship to explode and do really well? Let people have health care that they can rely on and not fear bankruptcy. But we don't do that.
I have a first person example of that. Rene Ritchie, who worked for iMore and a lot of other publications, decided he wanted to start a YouTube channel and really focus on, you know, building his YouTube presence and brand as his own, you know, personal stuff. And he could do it because he's Canadian. Mm-hmm. And he said, if I were in the United States, lost my health care, I couldn't do this. But I can do it because I have a nationalized health care in Canada.
Yeah.
And I'm not risking my my life and limb launching on my own. And he's done very well, which is great. I should make this a regular segment. And more Bored Ape Yacht Club's NFTs stolen in the middle of the night on Discord. From PC Magazine comes this story. Unbelievable. CoinDesk reports a hacker took control of the Discord account of Yuga Labs, the creators of the Bored Ape Yacht Club, of the community manager, Boris Wagner. That compromised account then used to share phishing links. It came from Boris. It's got to be real. To the official Discord channels for BAYC and Other Side, which Yuga Labs describes on its website as a gamified interoperable metaverse currently under development. This whole thing is so scammy all around. Mm-hmm. Coinbase said the hacker stole 145 ETH as well as the BAYC's NFTs. The price of the ETH was a mere $17.92 at the time of writing, but $618,000. Wait a minute. Oh, the price of ETH was $17.92. So the total was $260,000 in ETH, $358,000 worth of NFTs. Unbelievable. On April 25th, the company's Instagram account was compromised to steal $2.8 million worth of NFTs. The funny thing is, this is probably good publicity for NFTs because at least they say they're worth something. Who's going to buy these stolen NFTs? Is there still a market? I don't know. Just crazy.
This market is just an example of mass hypnosis, and I just blows my mind that this conversation can even be taking place. But then again, we live in a world now where people are buying into this stuff and cryptocurrencies and other things, partly because they have nothing left that they trust. They're watching governments.
I think that's what's happening. Yes,
they're watching governments inflate their money and take away value there. They're watching all kinds of things go on where they say, this is my only chance to put away something that I'm going to be able to have in the future. That's not true, but that's what they think. And, you know, people who are desperate are the easiest marks of the con men. And we're in a time of just endless cons. And I'm really afraid of what could happen. And the worst of it is that it's bad enough for the people who are getting suckered, and I do feel sorry for them, but I have a little less sympathy than they may want. The problem I'm seeing is that in a lot of this stuff has been entwined with the real economy in various kinds of financial instruments and such, that when this all fully collapses, as I think it may, it could bring down a whole lot of stuff by extension that we don't want to bring down. I'm very worried about how we're just letting these things go run wild without any serious law enforcement that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
There is some stirrings of that. There was some inside trading at OpenSea, which is a probably the biggest NFT trading platform in the world. And the government's getting involved in kind of prosecuting that. So I think we're starting to see it.
Insider trading action against the NFTs space. Mm. I think it is. It's Nate Chastain who was buying NFTs before they were public, promoting them on the OpenSea marketplace, you know, and when you get promoted, you know, hey, this is going to be a good one, they tend to sell, and then he would flip them. So he was getting to choose which are featured, and then he would flip them for 2 to 5 times what he paid. And this is one of the things a lot of people think, well, this is all anonymous. He thought, well, I'm using anonymous wallets and anonymous accounts, but apparently it's not fully anonymous to the government. So OpenSea did figure it out and fire him. So he's working, by the way, in case you want to invest in a new NFT project, Oval. That's just, here's your chance. Get in early. Because as you know, on these things, it's always good to be the first to buy, not the last to buy. Let's see. Now we're getting down to the seeds and stems, the dregs of the stories. You guys, we sent you 100 stories, and I apologize, more than 100, 130 stories. Let me see if there's anything else I really want to talk about before we take a quick break, because I do want to kind of celebrate 40 years of PC Magazine, which is really great. No, I think we'll just take a break. How about that? I don't see anything urgent. If you see anything, Dan or Alex or Jill, that you want to talk about, put a pin in it, and we'll get back to that in just a moment. This episode of This Week in Tech brought to you by Nareva. Nareva is so great if you're going back to work, but not everybody is. And you've got your conference rooms. Some employees will be there in the conference room. Some employees will be at home. And you don't want to disadvantage the people who aren't there. You want them to be able to hear what's going on in that meeting. And that's why you need Nareva. Sure, you could go get a big AV company. They'd install cameras, lots of microphones, lots of wires, technicians coming in, installers coming in. And by the way, those special rooms, they need to be constantly calibrated. That means more technicians coming in. And wait till you see the bill. Why do that when you could get great sound from Nareva? This is the more modern way of doing it. Nareva has patented the microphone mist technology. So one sound bar, if it's a really big room, you could put two sound bars in. Very simple. That's a speaker. And their microphone mist technology is built in, which literally puts Well, I guess it's figuratively, because they're not really putting thousands of microphones in the room, but it's like they are. Everybody in the room can be heard clearly, no matter where they're positioned, no matter where they're facing. It allows people in the room to move comfortably to social distance. Great for classrooms where people need to separate by 6 feet or more. It's so much simpler than a traditional system. You can install it yourself, just like a soundbar. And thanks to continuous auto calibration, your rooms are instantly and always ready with optimized audio. Nobody has to come in and calibrate it. In fact, Nareva will also give you a simplified console, the Nareva console, so your IT team can sit down the hall or across the country and coordinate, control, power, manage, and adjust all the rooms wirelessly, you know, over the internet. It's a fantastic technology. One or two integrated microphones and speaker bars fill a room with thousands of virtual microphones, so there are no dead zones. Everyone can be heard. Meeting participants, class participants, just talk naturally, move naturally in the space, and your remote participants can hear. They can participate. They don't feel left out. So everybody's working together as a team. This is exactly how conference rooms should be designed. 30-minute DIY job, big savings on time and cost compared to those traditional systems. I think you got to try it. Ask yourself, do you want to go with a costly, complicated traditional system or make the leap to something very modern, simple, economical, Nareva? It's Nureva. Do yourself a favor and check this out. Nareva.com. Nureva. Nareva.com. It is a revolution for conference rooms. We had a great week. Thank you, Nareva, by the way. We had a great week on Twit with lots of good things, and we've made a little mini movie for you to enjoy. Watch.
Although I think all movies, there we go.
There we go.
There we go. Let's see Jeff Jarvis now. Wait a minute.
Oh, boy. Oh, my.
That is, that's the inner Jeff channeling. You know, this is so stupid. This is so stupid.
God bless the internet, folks.
God bless the internet.
Oh.
Previously on Twit.
I am Ant Pruitt, and I want to share my quick thoughts on the Canon R5C, the hybrid mirrorless camera. This camera is, it is damn near perfect. Damn near perfect. It's just one or two things, really just one big thing that bugs me the most on it.
Tech News Weekly.
We talk with the lawyer and the law knowledgeable Denise Howell about the Texas SCOTUS ruling. And we get a nice refresher on how the court systems in the United States actually work, which I very much needed.
Security Now.
We're going to first examine the difficult to believe in 2022 design of Australia's New South Wales digital driver's license, which was sold to the public as being quite difficult to counterfeit. It's just, you know, some bureaucrat's nephew designed it or something. It's so bad.
Twit.tv. Tell your friends.
PC Magazine. I never worked for PC Magazine. I read it religiously. It was the king of the computer magazines back in the day. I remember the people who worked there and the editors there were gods. I remember going to Comdex and Bill McCrone was like royalty coming in. They used to have the big parties. There was a lot of money. I can't believe it's 40 years PC Magazine.
Yeah, Jill, you wrote an article about it. I didn't write an article about it.
Oh, okay.
There's a big celebration suite of content for the 40th anniversary. So PC Magazine, as it was called then, launched in 1982. And in that first issue was an interview with Bill Gates. So the current editor-in-chief.
Just starting, right? I mean, he wasn't.
Really early, Gates. Really early out. The current editor-in-chief went back and had an interview with him today, 40 years later, to see how he's thinking about things now and how the history of computing has shaped the world and what he's up to, what kind of gear he's using. So that's a really fun article to read. And there's some other great content. For example, a look back at 20 PCs that shaped the last 40 years of computing. That's a fun one. Lots of fun little graphics in there. And I know a lot of people are going to say, oh, the Amigo is missing and this is missing. It does have a little frame on it. This is like PCs that were covered by PC Magazine. But still a really fun read. And there's a great piece of video too, where a couple of the editors went back into a storage room and pulled out some of those old issues from the 80s. Mm. And some of them were 500 and 700 pages long. And they said, you know, why was this? Why were these issues so big? And it had to do with advertising.
Full page
and
ads,
not just
maybe.
That the advertising was, you know, making money for the magazine, but this is how people found out about where you could buy computing equipment and add-ons for your personal computer, because there was no internet, there was no online marketplace at that time. So you had to get the shipping rate for a magazine, for something to be officially called a magazine, you had to have a ratio of editorial to advertising. So the more ads that you sold, the more editorial you have to mix in order to get that magazine shipping rate. And so this is why a lot of people don't know this about the history of print magazine, but this is why so many magazines back in the day were so fat, was you needed to get that ratio of advertising to editorial, right?
And yet I think it's Computer Shopper, which had some editorial, PC's Zita Diff Davis, the owners of PC Magazine, spun that off probably when PC Magazine got thicker and thicker. They said, we need an even bigger format. It was a tabloid format magazine that was also inches thick, but it did not have a lot of editorial. Maybe they didn't mail it, or maybe they mailed it on a different rate, because it was just basically a...
You could have a lot of advertising. I think it was like upwards of 60-70% could be advertising. Like, it's a pretty high ratio.
Yeah, they did have editorial.
But those laws still hold today too for print, for anybody who works in print. I came up in print, so I definitely know those days of looking at pages and actually like laying out the magazine on a table and having a word count limit to what you could write.
I'm looking at the 20 most influential PCs. I agree, every one of them, really a great read. And what I didn't know is you've got every issue of PC Magazine available on the site, 550 issues. So you can read the first one. Oh, man.
And for people who don't know the history, so the print magazine of PC Magazine folded, I think, at the end of 2010. So it was roughly 30 years, maybe 28 years of print magazine. And now it goes by the name PCMag.com.
Right.
And today, you know, every now and again, I get an email from readers saying, you don't do as much high level nerdy stuff as you used to do. You don't talk about this really in-depth personal computing. And the truth of the matter is, we still do. There is still a good amount of, you know, stories about building your own rigs or whatever. But we cover a lot more now because technology has changed and it really is for more people now. And the way that we use technology, the way that it's integrated into our lives, affects everyone. So we try to approach it in a way that we can give advice, buying advice for products, and how-to advice for using those products to be applicable to everybody so that anybody could read those articles and really understand what they need to understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that that's true. I mean, remember stereo magazines in the 50s? I mean, Dan, you remember it. Yeah, I remember it. These young.
Not the 50s, but
but in the early days, it was about, you know, you'd play the 1812 Overture because the cannons would really test the RMS capacity of your amplifier and your big, Altec Lansing speakers. And then after a while, it became more about content and less about the speeds and fees. And I think the same thing happened with the computer industry. A little story I don't think I've ever told before. When we first started doing Twit 17 years ago, we weren't going to do ads, but finally we decided, all right, we're going to have to do an ad-supported network because that's the only way we can go forward. But nobody had set ad prices for podcasts at all. So I called PC Magazine and said, what do you charge for a full-page ad? And I figured, well, we're not PC Magazine, but also your ad isn't competing with a bunch of other ads. you have to kind of listen to hear it. So I found out what their price. I cut about $40 off CPM. And that was how we established the price for podcast advertising. And you know what? It kind of held.
Oh, wow.
So it was as seat of the pants as it was.
One of the things about PC Magazine and the things in that genre, and it's true today of a lot of still a lot of sites and remaining magazines. When we talk about editorial content versus advertising, in a really interesting way, the advertising was content that I wanted to look at. Exactly. This is how I got a sense of what was actually going on. I'm into computer-based music, and I still subscribe to a couple of magazines that, for me, the advertising is at least as important as the editorial because I have a much better sense of what's really happening in that industry and an idea of things I might want to look at more closely. So I think it's hilarious that there's this I know that the rule is for very good reasons and for postal reasons that you want to have a robust national discussion, and that's what the postage rates are about. But I just think that one of the things I miss is leafing through and not turning pages past the advertising the way I do with the New York Times magazine on Sunday, where really I'm not interested in the advertising. I'm interested only in the articles, where it was both in the case of this.
I completely agree with you that there was a certain merit in advertising in that case because it was something you wanted to know about. Mm-hmm. And it was a new industry and it was exciting and you wanted to know about these new companies and what they were offering. And every single ad was just as important probably as the articles. I think that's a really good point. Maybe that's exactly what advertising should be in a way, right? Instead of trying to figure out what people want, we'll do affinity-based content and advertise. That's how we sell our ads.
And the important part is to keep it straight, which is which, and not to merge the two.
Yes.
And PC Magazine has had a very good record of doing very honest good. Editorial.
Yes.
And sometimes labeling becomes an issue, but I want both.
Yeah. No, in fact, I learned, from the best when I worked for Ziff Davis for a while, never wrote for PC Magazine, but I worked for them and Bill McCrone and Lance Ulanoff and Jim Lauterbach and their ethical standards, at Ziff Davis Television and everything they did were so high. And that's the standard we want to keep. I remember Jim going around the studio and putting black tape over all the brand names of the product in the studio. So it wouldn't become an ad for that product or this product or that product.
I'll tell you another big benefit of working from home is you don't overhear people at the water cooler talking about what ads sold or how much money was made off of something. Cause every now and then it would happen. You'd be like, oh God, I don't want to, I don't want to know. Don't tell me that.
I remember, we were going to do a segment on the screensavers about how to hack the Xbox. And Microsoft was a massive advertiser at the time on ZDTV. And I think reasonably we might have been a little over concerned, but we said, we just want to let you know we're going to do this and Microsoft is not going to like it. And to their credit, the editorial people and the ad people said, no, do it. It's important. It's journalism. And we'll deal with the blowback. And there was a lot of blowback. I think Microsoft maybe. In fact, I can remember that happened with some magazines too, where Microsoft said, all right, well, that's it. No more ads. But, when you're PC Magazine, nobody's going to say, no, we're not going to buy ads there anymore. You mentioned computer music, Dan, a key figure in the development of computer music passed away this week. Dave Smith, who was the inventor of MIDI. He was at a company called Sequential Circuits, created a number of sequencers and programmers to be used with the Moog and ARP synthesizers back in the day. He helped design the Prophet, which was a very popular synthesizer. You've heard it on Thriller and Madonna's Like a Virgin. Vangelis used it in his Chariots of Fire. He also developed MIDI, which stands for Musical Instrument Digital Interface. It allowed you to synchronize your instrument. In fact, to this day, I think even if you're connecting via USB, you're using the MIDI protocol when you connect an instrument.
MIDI is the TCP/IP of music.
Yeah.
And it is, you cannot overstate how important it was and what it influenced in standards making and rules making protocols in the future by other people. It was the thing everyone looked to say, see, it can be done. And the industry cooperated. It's just a tremendous achievement and something that we all have benefited from.
Dave Smith, the inventor, passed at the age of 72. If you want to see a beautiful picture of him with his synthesizers, go to sequential.com. And I thought it'd be appropriate to mention that. I didn't know, Dan, that you were into computer music.
But, back in my 20s, I played music for a living for a few years. So it was,
We also, and we'll talk more about this on Mac Break Weekly because he was a good friend of Alex Lindsay's, but a member of the family, John Foster, who was an early contributor to Mac Break shows, actually came up with the name Pixel Core, has passed away as well, far too young. But we will talk. We'll I think, give him a more fitting memories on Mac Break Weekly because, of course, Alex and he were close friends, and I remember him very well. He was a great man to work with. And we will miss him as well. That was a fun show. I think we should do more shows from my home. Dan Gilmore, thank you so much for being here. Dan is at ASU. Do you teach today? Do you still talk to kids and all of that?
I've been doing online for a number of years at this point. It's why the pandemic It was a time where very little changed for me, and I was in Japan for most of the first 2 years.
Yeah.
So it was. It's been. I want to read Jill's book. We've been living it for quite a while, and it's. I like it.
You know, it's funny because the pandemic didn't affect any of us much because we're all, for the most part, working from home. So it's just more of the same for all of our family. Thank you, Dan, co-founder of the Arizona State University News Co-Lab at the Walter Cronkite.
It's great to be here.
Always great to have you. Jill Duffy, so nice to see you.
Thank you.
Deputy Managing Editor at PC Magazine and the author of a fabulous book. No. Hold that up longer. The Everything Guide to Remote Work. If you don't need it, you know somebody who does. Give it to that person who always joins the calls muted. you're on mute.
That's the default, and it should be.
Unmute. All right. Give it to that person. You're right. I agree. It should be. And Alex Wilhelm, I cannot say it with greater pleasure. Congratulations to you and your wife. That is the best news. I know you were trying because I could tell you were exhausted, but you don't know.
There's the Leo comment of the show.
You do not know from exhaustion. And you will in 6 months, I promise you, my friend, and we will celebrate that day. Congratulations. That is wonderful. Wonderful.
If I look tired, it was the two IVF cycles.
You and Liza,
may you enjoy your many weeks off.
Oh, God.
Hell yeah.
So how long? You don't really know how long you want to take off.
I'm thinking most of Q1.
Good.
Yeah.
Great.
If not all of it.
Calling parental leave time off is kind of a questionable concept.
I'm going to not sleep for hopefully all of Q1.
Oh, yeah. It's harder, much harder work. You won't. I was so happy to get back to work.
May that happen.
Please let me go back to work. Do you have family around? Yeah, you do, right?
My spouse's parents live nearby, and I'm going to fly in. Both of my parents are great with kids.
Good.
And this is going to be the 10th grandchild in my family.
Oh.
So I'm going to I'm the youngest. So,
they're experienced.
Fly them in too. Yeah. We're going to have a village.
They will be wonderful.
Know anything.
Let them do everything for as long as they're willing to stay.
Yeah.
And just prepare yourself because the day they fly off – That's the day your troubles begin.
Yeah, I'm just glad that my spouse is a physician, because I don't know any guys. I'm a technology and finance journalist. Like, I'm the most useless person around a baby.
Oh, so no, you're gonna be great. You're gonna be a great dad. You're gonna love it so much. Yeah, you're gonna have a great time. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We normally, if the studio is working, we'll do Twit on a Sunday afternoon at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC. Today, for the first time in, I think, must be 15 years, we did not have a live audience because I didn't want to stream and challenge my bandwidth. So normally you can watch live at live.twit.tv or listen live and chat at irc.twit.tv. I know the chat room is going crazy right now because they don't know what's happening. you can also join our club and chat with us in the Discord. The Club Twit is actually three different benefits in one: ad-free versions of all the shows. It includes access to our Discord, which is a wonderful community. Lots of events in there, shows that we don't put out on the podcast and feeds and so forth. And you also get the Twit Plus feed, which will include stuff that never made it to podcasts for a variety of reasons. All of that is $7 a month. Nothing. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up today. Thank you in advance. After the fact, all the shows are available, commercials intact, at the website, twit.tv. There's a YouTube channel for all of our shows. And there's also, of course, and it's the easiest thing to do, you can get a podcast player and subscribe, and that way you'll get it automatically the minute it's available. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you next time, hopefully in our studio. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye.